Chapter 2. It was my wife's idea to hold the private view on Friday. "We're out to catch the critics this time," she said. "It's high time they began to take you seriously, and they know it. This is their chance. If you open on Monday, they'll most of them have just come up from the country, and they'll dash off a few paragraphs before dinner. I'm only worrying about the weeklies, of course. If we give them the weekend to think about it, we shall have them in an urbane Sunday in the country mood. They'll settle down after a good luncheon, tuck up their cuffs, and turn out a nice, leisurely, full-length essay, which they'll reprint later in a nice little book. Nothing less will do this time." She was up and down from the old rectory several times during the month of preparation, revising the list of invitations and helping with the hanging. On the morning of the private view, I telephoned to Julia and said, "I'm sick of the pictures already and never want to see them again, but I suppose I shall have to put in an appearance. Do you want me to come?" "I'd much rather you didn't." "Celia sent a card with 'Bring everyone' written across it in green ink. When do we meet?" "In the train. You might pick up my luggage." "If you'll have it packed soon, I'll pick you up too and drop you at the gallery. I've got a fitting next door at 12. When I reached the gallery, my wife was standing looking through the window to the street. Behind her, half a dozen unknown picture lovers were moving from canvas to canvas, catalogue in hand. They were people who had once bought a woodcut and were consequently on the gallery's list of patrons. "No one has come yet," said my wife. "I've been here since 10 and it's been very dull. Whose car was that you came in?"
"Julia's."
"Julia's? Why didn't you bring her in? Oddly enough, I've just been talking about Brideshead to a funny little man who seemed to know us very well. He said he was called Mr. Samgrass. Apparently he's one of Lord Copper's middle-aged young men on the Daily Beast. I tried to feed him some paragraphs, but he seemed to know more about you than I do. He said he'd met me years ago at Brideshead. I wish Julia had come in, then we could have asked her about him."
"I remember him well. He's a crook."
"Yes, that stuck out a mile. He's been talking all about what he calls the Brideshead set. Apparently Rex Mottram has made the place a nest of party mutiny. Did you know? What would Theresa Marchmain have thought?"
"I'm going there tonight."
"Not tonight, Charles. You can't go there tonight. You're expected at home. You promised, as soon as the exhibition was ready, you'd come home. John and Nanny have made a banner with 'Welcome' on it, and you haven't seen Caroline yet."
"I'm sorry, it's all settled."
"Besides, Daddy will think it's so odd, and Boy is home for Sunday, and you haven't seen the new studio. You can't go tonight. Did they ask me?"
"Of course, but I knew you wouldn't be able to come."
"I can't now. I could have, if you'd let me know earlier. I should adore to see the Brideshead set at home. I do think you're perfectly beastly, but this is no time for a family rumpus. The Clarences promised to come in before luncheon. They may be here any minute." We were interrupted, however, not by royalty, but by a woman reporter from one of the dailies, whom the manager of the gallery now led up to us. She had not come to see the pictures, but to get a human story of the dangers of my journey. I left her to my wife, and next day read in the paper, "Charles, stately Holmes' rider, steps off the map. That the snakes and vampires of the jungle have nothing on Mayfair is the opinion of socialite artist Ryder, who has abandoned the houses of the great for the ruins of equatorial Africa." The rooms began to fill, and I was soon busy being civil. My wife was everywhere, greeting people, introducing people, deftly transforming the crowd into a party. I saw her lead friends forward one after another to the subscription list that had been opened for the book of Ryder's Latin America. I heard her say, "No, darling, I'm not at all surprised, but you wouldn't expect me to be, would you? You see, Charles lives for one thing, beauty. I think he got bored with finding it ready-made in England. He had to go and create it for himself. He wanted new worlds to conquer. After all, he has said the last word about country houses, hasn't he? Not, I mean, that he's given that up altogether. I'm sure he'll always do one or two more for friends." A photographer brought us together, flashed a lamp in our faces, and let us part. Presently there was a slight hush, and edging away which follows the entry of a royal party. I saw my wife curtsey and heard her say, "Oh, sir, you are sweet," and then I was led into the clearing, and the Duke of Clarence said,
"Pretty hot out there, I should think."
"It was, sir."
"Awfully clever, the way you've hit off the impression of heat. Makes me feel quite uncomfortable in my greatcoat. Ha, ha, ha."
When they'd gone, my wife said, "Goodness, we're late for lunch. Margot's giving a party in your honour." And in the taxi she said, "I've just thought of something. Why don't you write and ask the Duchess of Clarence's permission to dedicate Latin America to her?"
"Why should I?"
"She'd love it so." I wasn't thinking of dedicating it to anyone. "There you are. That's typical of you, Charles. Why miss an opportunity to give pleasure?" There were a dozen at luncheon, and though it pleased my hostess and my wife to say that they were there in my honour, it was plain to me that half of them did not know of my exhibition, and had come because they had been invited and had no other engagement. Throughout luncheon they talked, without stopping, of Mrs. Simpson, but they all, or nearly all, came back with us to the gallery. The hour after luncheon was the busiest time. There were representatives of the Tate Gallery and the National Art Collections Fund, who all promised to return shortly with colleagues and, in the meantime, reserved certain pictures for further consideration. The most influential critic, who in the past had dismissed me with a few wounding commendations, peered out at me from between his slouch hat and woollen muffler, gripped my arm and said, "I knew you had it. I saw it there. I've been waiting for it." From fashionable and unfashionable lips alike, I heard fragments of praise. "If you'd asked me to guess," I overheard, "Riders is the last name would have occurred to me. They're so virile, so passionate." They all thought they had found something new. It had not been thus at my last exhibition in these same rooms, shortly before my going abroad. Then there had been an unmistakable note of weariness. Then the talk had been less of me than of the houses, anecdotes of their owners. That same woman, it came back to me, who now applauded my virility and passion, had stood quite near me before a painfully laboured canvas and said, "So facile." I remembered the exhibition, too, for another reason. It was the week I detected my wife in adultery. Then, as now, she was a tireless hostess, and I heard her say, "Whenever I see anything lovely nowadays, a building or a piece of scenery, I think to myself, 'That's by Charles. I see everything through his eyes. He is England to me.'" I heard her say that. It was the sort of thing she had the habit of saying. Throughout our married life, again and again, I had felt my bowels shrivel within me at the things she said. But that day, in this gallery, I heard her unmoved, and suddenly realised that she was powerless to hurt me any more. I was a free man. She had given me my manumission in that brief, sly lapse of hers. My cuckold's horns made me lord of the forest. At the end of the day, my wife said, "Darling, I must go. It's been a terrific success, hadn't it? I'll think of something to tell them at home, but I wish it hadn't got to happen quite this way." "So she knows," I thought. "She's a sharp one. She's had her nose down since luncheon and picked up the scent." I let her get clear of the place and was about to follow. The rooms were nearly empty. When I heard a voice at the turnstile I had not heard for many years. An unforgettable, self-taught stammer, a sharp cadence of remonstrance. "No, I have not brought a card of invitation. I do not even know whether I received one. I have not come to a social function. I do not seek to scrape acquaintance with Lady Celia. I do not want my photograph in the Tatler. I have not come to exhibit myself. I have come to see the pictures. Perhaps you are unaware that there are any pictures here. I happen to have a personal interest in the artist, if that word has any meaning for you." "Antoine," I said, "come in." "My dear, there is a Gorgon here, who thinks I am gate-crashing. I only arrived in London yesterday, and heard quite by chance at luncheon that you were having an exhibition. So, of course, I dashed impetuously to the shrine to pay homage. Have I changed? Would you recognise me? Where are the pictures? Let me explain them to you." Anthony Blanche had not changed from when I last saw him, not indeed from when I first saw him. He swept lightly across the room to the most prominent canvas, a jungle landscape. Paused a moment, his head cocked like a knowing terrier, and asked, "Where, my dear Charles, did you find this sumptuous greenery? The corner of a hothouse at Trent or Tring? What gorgeous usurer nurtured these fronds for your pleasure?" Then he made a tour of the two rooms. Once or twice he sighed deeply. Otherwise he kept silence. When he came to the end, he sighed once more, more deeply than ever, and said, "But they tell me, my dear, you are happy in love. That is everything, is it not? Or nearly everything?" "Are they as bad as that?" Anthony dropped his voice to a piercing whisper. "My dear, let us not expose your little imposture before these good plain people." He gave a conspiratorial glance to the last remnants of the crowd. "Let us not spoil their innocent pleasure. We know, you and I, this is all terrible tripe. Let us go, before we offend the connoisseurs. I know of a louche little bar, quite near here. Let us go there and talk of your other conquests." It needed this voice from the past to recall me. The indiscriminate chatter of praise all that crowded day
had worked on me like a succession of advertisement hoardings on a long road, kilometre after kilometre between the poplars, commanding one to stay at some new hotel. So that when at the end of the drive, stiff and dusty, one arrives at the destination, it seems inevitable to turn into the yard under the name that had first bored, then angered one, and finally become an inseparable part of one's fatigue. Anthony led me from the gallery and down a side street to a door between a disreputable newsagent and a disreputable chemist, painted with the words, Blue Grotto Club, members only.
Not quite your milieu, my dear, but mine, I assure you. After all, you have been in your milieu all day.
He led me downstairs, from a smell of cats to a smell of gin and cigarette ends and the sound of a wireless.
I was given the address by a dirty old man in the Berthe de l'Artois. I am most grateful to him. I've been out of England so long, and really sympathetic little joints like this change so fast. I presented myself here for the first time yesterday evening, and already I feel quite at home. Good evening, Cyril.
Lo, Tony, back again? Said the youth behind the bar.
We will take our drinks and sit in a corner. You must remember, my dear, that here you are just as conspicuous, and may I say abnormal, my dear, as I should be in Bratz.
The place was painted cobalt. There was cobalt linoleum on the floor. Fishes of silver and gold paper had been pasted haphazard on ceilings and walls. Half a dozen youths were drinking and playing with the slot machines. An older, natty, crapulous-looking man seemed to be in control. There was some sniggering round the fruit gum machine. Then one of the youths came up to us and said,
Would your friend care to rumba?
No, Tom, he would not, and I'm not going to give you a drink, not yet anyway. That's a very impudent boy, a regular little gold digger, my dear.
Well, I said, affecting an ease I was far from feeling in that den, what have you been up to all these years?
My dear, it is what you have been up to that we are here to talk about. I've been watching you, my dear. I'm a faithful old body, and I've kept my eye on you.
As he spoke, the bar and the bartender, the blue wicker furniture, the gambling machines, the gramophone, the couple of youths dancing on the oilcloth, the youth sniggering round the slots, the purple-veined, stiffly-dressed elderly gentleman drinking in the corner opposite us, the whole drab and furtive joint seemed to fade. And I was back in Oxford, looking out over Christchurch Meadow through a window of Ruskin Gothic.
"I went to your first exhibition," said Anthony. "I found it charming. There was an interior of Marchemain House, very English, very correct, but quite delicious. Charles has done something," I said. Not all he will do, not all he can do, but something.
Even then, my dear, I wondered a little.
It seemed to me that there was something a little gentlemanly about your painting. You must remember, I am not English. I cannot understand this keen zest to be well-bred. English snobbery is more macabre to me even than English morals. However, I said, Charles has done something delicious. What will he do next?
The next thing I saw was your very handsome volume, Village and Provincial Architecture, was it called? Quite a tome, my dear, and what did I find? Charm again.
Not quite my cup of tea, I thought. This is too English.
I have the fancy for rather spicy things, you know. Not for the shade of the cedar tree, the cucumber sandwich, the silver cream jug, the English girl dressed in whatever English girls do wear for tennis. Not that. Not Jane Austen. Not Miss Mitford. Then to be frank, dear Charles, I despaired of you. I am a degenerate old dago, I said, and Charles, I speak of your art, my dear, is a dean's daughter in a flowered muslin. Imagine then my excitement at luncheon today. Everyone was talking about you. My hostess was a friend of my mother's, a Mrs. Stuyvesant Oglander. A friend of yours too, my dear, such a frump. Not at all the society I imagined you to keep. However, they had all been to your exhibition, but it was you they talked of, how you had broken away, my dear, gone to the tropics, become a Gauguin, a Rambo. You can imagine how my old heart leapt. Poor Celia, they said, after all she's done for him. He owes her everything. It's too bad. And with Julia, they said, after the way she behaved in America, just as she was going back to Rex.
But the pictures, I said, tell me about them.
Oh, the pictures, they said, they're most peculiar, not at all what he usually does. Very forceful, quite barbaric. I call them downright unhealthy, said Mrs. Stuyvesant Oglander. My dear, I could hardly keep still in my chair. I wanted to dash out of the house and leap in a taxi and say, take me to Charles's unhealthy pictures.
Well, I went. But the gallery after luncheon was so full of absurd women in the sort of hats they should be made to eat that I rested a little. I rested here with Cyril and Tom and these saucy boys. Then I came back at the unfashionable time of 5 o'clock, all agog, my dear, and what did I find? I found, my dear, a very naughty and very successful practical joke. It reminded me of dear Sebastian when he liked so much to dress up in false whiskers. It was charm again, my dear, simple, creamy English charm playing tigers.
You're quite right, I said.
My dear, of course I'm right. I was right years ago, more years, I'm happy to say, than either of us shows, when I warned you. I took you out to dinner to warn you of charm. I warned you expressly and in great detail of the Flight family. Charm is the great English blight. It does not exist outside these damp islands. It spots and kills anything it touches. It kills love. It kills art. I greatly fear, my dear Charles, it has killed you.
The youth called Tom approached us again.
Don't be a tease, Tony. Buy me a drink.
I remembered my train and left Anthony with him. As I stood on the platform by the restaurant car, I saw my luggage and Julia's go past, with Julia's sour-faced maid strutting beside the porter. They had begun shutting the carriage doors when Julia arrived, unhurried, and took her place in front of me. I had a table for two. This was a very convenient train. There was half an hour before dinner and half an hour after it. Then, instead of changing to the branch line, as had been the rule in Lady Marchmain's day, we were met at the junction. It was night as we drew out of Paddington, and the glow of the town gave place first to the scattered lights of the suburbs, then to the darkness of the fields.
"It seems days since I saw you," I said.
6 hours, and we were together all yesterday. You look worn out."
"It's been a day of nightmare. Crowds, critics, the Clarences, a luncheon party at Margot's, ending up with half an hour's well-reasoned abuse of my pictures in a pansy bar. I think Celia knows about us."
"Well, she had to know some time."
"Everyone seems to know. My pansy friend had not been in London 24 hours before he'd heard."
"Damn everybody."
"What about Rex?"
"Rex isn't anybody at all," said Julia. "He just doesn't exist."
The knives and forks jingled on the table as we sped through the darkness. The little circle of gin and vermouth in the glasses lengthened to oval, contracted again with the sway of the carriage, touched the lip, lapped back again, never spilt. I was leaving the day behind me. Julia pulled off her hat and tossed it into the rack above her, and shook her night-dark hair with a little sigh of ease. A sigh fit for the pillow, the sinking firelight, and a bedroom window open to the stars and the whisper of bare trees.
"It's great to have you back, Charles, like the old days."
"Like the old days," I thought.
Rex, in his early 40s, had grown heavy and ruddy. He had lost his Canadian accent and inquired instead the hoarse, ruddy tone that was common to all his friends, as though their voices were perpetually strained to make themselves heard above a crowd, as though, with youth forsaking them, there was no time to wait the opportunity to speak, no time to listen, no time to reply. Time for a laugh, a throaty, mirthless laugh, the base currency of goodwill. There were half a dozen of these friends in the Tapestry Hall. Politicians, young conservatives in the early 40s, with sparse hair and high blood pressure. A socialist from the coal mine who had already caught their clear accents, whose cigars came to pieces on his lips, whose hand shook when he poured himself out a drink. A financier older than the rest and, one might guess from the way they treated him, richer. A lovesick columnist who alone was silent, gloating somberly on the only woman of the party, a woman they called Grizel, a knowing rake whom in their hearts they all feared a little. They all feared Julia too, Grizel included. She greeted them and apologised for not being there to welcome them, with a formality which hushed them for a minute. Then she came and sat with me near the fire, and the storm of talk arose once more and whirled about her ears.
"Of course you can marry her and make her queen tomorrow. We had our chance in October. Why didn't we send the Italian fleet to the bottom of Mare Nostrum? Why didn't we blow Spezia to blazes? Why didn't we land on Pantelleria?
Franco's simply a German agent. They tried to put him in to prepare air bases to bomb France. That bluff has been called anyway.
It would make the monarchy stronger than it's been since Tudor times. The people are with him.
The press are with him. I'm with him.
Who cares about divorce now, except a few old maids who aren't married anyway?
If he has a showdown with the old gang, they'll just disappear.
Why didn't we close the canal? Why didn't we bomb Rome?
It wouldn't have been necessary. One firm note. one firm speech, one showdown. Anyway, Franco will soon be skipping back to Morocco. Chap I saw today just come from Barcelona. Chap just come from Fort Belvedere. Chap just come from the Palazzo Venezia. All we want is a showdown. A showdown with Baldwin. A showdown with Hitler. A showdown with the old gang. That I should live to see my country, the land of Clive and Nelson, my country of Hawkins and Drake, my country of Palmerston.
Would you mind very much not doing that? Said Grizel to the columnist, who had been attempting, in a maudlin manner, to twist her wrist. I don't happen to enjoy it.
I wonder which is the more horrible, I said, Celia's art and fashion, or Rex's politics and money. Why worry about them? Oh, my darling, why is it that love makes me hate the world? It's supposed to have quite the opposite effect. I feel as though all mankind, and God too, were a conspiracy against us. They are, they are. But we've got our happiness in spite of them, here and now. We've taken possession of it. They can't hurt us, can they? Not tonight, not now. Not for how many nights?